Welcome to Augmented Humanity. Our guests are modern explorers working at the intersection of technology and the humanities. They help us to understand ourselves and the worlds we create in this digital age. They are thinkers, creators, makers, and academics working in diverse fields like technology, ethics, civics and government, and education. I'm your host, Craig Goldsmith.
I'm your host, Ellen Dornan.
We're joined by Hillary Cleary, an interactive designer at IDEUM, who works with her team in Corrales to create, develop, and manufacture multi-touch, immersive, and interactive exhibits for museums across the country. Recent projects can be seen at the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum, the World War II Museum, and the National Cowgirl Hall of Fame. We're also joined by Ethan Ortega, instructional coordinator for the New Mexico Department of Cultural Affairs Historic Sites Division, who worked with students at New Mexico Highlands University to reimagine the exhibits at the Jemez Historic Site Visitor Center, which opened to the public in May 18, 2019. In this episode, we'll be talking about what kind of experience museum designers want to create. We talked a little bit about competing with entertainment, and so I kind of want to dig into that a little deeper. Is fun or entertainment a fundamental element of these kind of exhibits? Is that something that you both are trying to bring to the table to engage people? Does it have to be fun?
Well,
and if so, why?
I don't think it has to be fun, but I think the problem, as we were discussing earlier, is just essentially that there's so much competition out there for people's attention. And I think the day and age in which we live is increasingly one of screens and media and consumption of video and audio and media at a rate that's sort of unprecedented. And because of that, I do think that museums need to adapt. We have conversations about this a lot when we're creating exhibits, you know, that balance between education and sort of engagement, and how much is a person really going to pay attention to something, and how long are they going to take to read something. And oftentimes when we do user testing, you know, we find that keeping text as concise and minimal as possible, even in an exhibit that's historical or interpretive, actually keeps people engaged for longer because they get stuck. If you have a massive wall of text, someone isn't going to want to read all of it, unfortunately, in this day and age. So engaging other senses, because we have the capacity to, is a really powerful way to keep someone involved and engaged with an exhibit for a longer amount of time.
And are you seeing the same thing, Ethan?
Absolutely, yeah. So, you know, there's been tons of studies done in traditional museum settings on how long people spend at information panels and in front of exhibit cases. It's often like less than 10 seconds per panel.
And
So, I mean, you know, it doesn't matter if you have paragraphs of text, you're not going to convey very much information. And really, text isn't the only way to convey information. You know, the saying, a picture is worth 1,000 words, well, a 3D model is worth 1,000,000. So it allows you to connect and to allow visitors to generate their own understanding of the objects and of the sites.
I'm hearing a lot about that sort of visitor agency so that they can sort of tailor or tune what they're engaging with and what's happening. I'm also hearing from both of you about studies, about user testing. So how do you go about measuring these sorts of interactions? Do you actually plan for it? Do you test for it? And what does that look like? I mean, do you do like focus groups? Do you have, you know, like engageometers?
It's happened before. It totally depends on the project. So for us, it's really going to depend on a variety of factors. A lot of it has to do with what the client wants and what the budget is ultimately of the project. So a lot of the times, a really useful way that we test our exhibits are open houses and getting the community to come and play with the exhibits. And, you know, we did that for the National Cowgirl Hall of Fame project that I worked on and got to see a variety of different ages interacting with it. You know, people bring their children, they bring their grandparents, and those events are meant to be fun. Oftentimes, there's a couple of us lurking around the corners watching people interact with our exhibits. And then sometimes we do more formal testing, especially for children's exhibits. exhibits. We've had a couple sessions for some of the Biopark exhibits where we've brought kids in and then actually had formal interviews with them, you know, just asking them a couple quick questions after they use the exhibit, you know, asking how fun was it? Was it easy or hard? One that I'm thinking of is for the Biopark. It's essentially you become a penguin, and through Kinect technology, it registers your motion. So you're being tracked and then you control a penguin basically and have to swim through an obstacle course. But that was very challenging to get right, you know, to get the timing right of all those movements and motion, and required us to actually interview people as we were developing it.
Have you ever had total fails?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, they never quite work how you expect them to when you're designing them. And so one of the things that we're trying to do more often is just very iterative design, and human-centered design is something we've been having a lot of conversations about. And getting as many people involved early on in the process of prototyping something, even if you're just using a pen and paper and talking it out with potential clients, like, you know, how would this work? Is this button natural for you? And what we found is, honestly, if something is less designed, if it's just some cardboard or cutouts on a piece of paper, people are more willing to engage with it because it doesn't look real.
Can you unpack a human-centered design a little bit? I mean, one of the things that struck me learning about immersive exhibits is the extent to which exhibit designers have to consider the human body in the space and what the human is going to do with their body in that immersive space.
Human-centered design is exactly what it sounds like. It's the idea that at the very beginning and from all stages onwards in the design process, what you're considering is the end user above everything else. So there's a series of modules or processes that you can go through to sort of ensure that you are engaging with your target audience as best you can. So some of the things that it looks like is what I was describing with just really simple paper prototyping and getting people, potential users, involved early on. And then it's also discussions with the client and museum about the audience that this exhibit is going to be for. So one example I can think of is the World War II Museum in New Orleans. We developed an exhibit about Bob Hope's USO tours, and it was for an event that the museum was having to commemorate the anniversary of World War II. So we knew that the audience was going to be older. You know, we knew that people would be less likely to be familiar with touch technology. And so that really factored into how we chose to design the exhibit. And ultimately, I feel like it affects every step after that. It affects where buttons are going to be placed. It affects the colors you use, the size of the font, how complex the interactions are. It can be quite comprehensive.
And really, that's like the direction I think that most like interpretation is moving, because it creates a more empathetic design. We use several different design processes, like you were talking about. Our favorite of which is actually developed by a professor here at UNM, and it's called Wrong Theory Protocol by Vanessa Spiva. Yeah.
I love Vanessa.
And so we actually just used Wrong Theory Protocol to design our new Junior Ranger program at Coronado Historic Site. And, you know, it, like I said, it provides a more empathetic view, and then a more, you know, human-based design.
You all are working in a slightly different context on some of your immersive stuff. What kinds of immersions are you all looking at? I mean, Hillary's talked about touch screens, and you said there's buttons. When you mean buttons, do you mean an actual physical button? But what sort of
digital button?
Okay,
on
see,
the
that's
screen.
Why I'm asking. Well, no, see, that's because
it could be a physical button.
Yeah,
sometimes
when I think
is.
Of a button, I think of like a big arcade button.
Yes.
But what sort of other interfaces for immersions? We've talked about projections, touch screens. You had said that some of your exhibits are, you think of any historic site as an immersive thing, where if you can pick up an object. I know that IDEM also has worked on some tactile interfaces. You have like a puck,
yes.
Kind of a...
Yeah, so that was actually in the World War II exhibit I described. We had two different modes. So there was just a touch-only mode where you only use your fingers, but then we had a secondary mode using a tangible object is what we call them. It's essentially just a little circular puck that kind of looks like a hockey puck, and there's different patterns on the bottom of it, and those patterns can be read by the table. So depending on where they are, you'll get a different sort of interaction. So for that exhibit in particular, all that it was doing was driving the interaction. So we had this little puck, and we had a little 3D printed plane fabricated on the top that was a specific type of plane used by Bob Hope in his tours. And then the visitor could just take that, essentially, the object was on the top of the table, and depending on where they moved it on the touchscreen, they would control what they were seeing on the other part of the application.
Like a pawn on a chessboard,
yes.
Almost.
Yes.
What are some things that would be sort of outside what people would think of when you say immersive or video projection digital exhibits?
Yeah, so we're doing a lot of similar things with the touchscreens and projections and all of that. I'd mentioned briefly earlier our bathrooms. And, we have a very limited exhibit space at most of our historic sites. And so, you know, we're kind of venturing out into spaces we wouldn't normally put information. And so currently we have a volcano, an experiential volcano bathroom. And then we're currently working on a night sky bathroom, which allows visitors when they go in to experience a night sky in the Hamas Mountains. But then when you flip the switch on, it becomes a daytime scene. Just giving people little experiences like that. Also, we've been doing a lot of 360-degree spherical photos throughout our properties. Some of our properties are really small, and you can see the whole thing in one visit. Some of them are very large, and there's places that people just aren't allowed access to. So this allows us to capture these and show them in a VR headset or on an iPad or touchscreen that allows people to see in these places. And now that Facebook and other social media venues allow, the hosting of 360-degree photos, we can send it out into the world, too. And, like I said, we're really based on place-based learning. But by taking these spherical images and headsets, we can go to, like, makers' fairs.
Right, right.
Or schools.
And show people. Yeah,
and put people right in the center of an excavation or, out in the middle of nowhere on one of our monuments.
And what about audio? Are you recording audio with those also?
In some part, for sure. Another kind of immersive experience that we've done at Hamas is Toa language. There's only one Pueblo that speaks Toa, and that's Hamas Pueblo. And it's very rare to find recordings of it, and the Pueblo doesn't allow it to be written. So it's a very isolated language. And we did all of our oral histories in Toa and in English and captioned them. So when visitors come in, they are immediately surrounded by voices in Toa, which kind of, transports you maybe to another time, but also to another culture that the visitors aren't familiar with.
The audio, it doesn't overwhelm you, but it certainly predominates your experience. It certainly sets the tone for the experience. How you prioritize what senses are going to be titillated, what led to making the decision that would be the primary sense engaged?
We do a lot of thematic planning with exhibit. We try to identify a big idea and then themes and sub-themes for that. And really the big idea for the Hamas exhibit was a history from the Toa perspective, from the Toa voice. And that led to the Toa voice becoming the primary thing that inhabited the space there.
It sounds like there's an opportunity here to tell stories that just haven't been told before in traditional museum or historic site settings. That's something that's been crucial, certainly in New Mexico, where we're all based, which is whether you want to call it anti-history or revisionist history or alternative history or
absent narrative.
Exactly. And it sounds like there's a really good opportunity to be doing that in these sort of contexts, especially with the kind of multi-sensory nature of an immersive exhibit.
By having these immersive environments, it makes the subject and the context more real. Often when you go into museum exhibits, and most of these exhibits that we're redoing in the historic sites are from the 70s.
Ouch.
So a lot has changed. There's this thing called NAGPRA, right, that requires, government entities to consult with grave goods and objects of cultural significance. And so, a lot has changed. And so we really have an opportunity to bring it into another century. century. It changes indigenous people from being this kind of Wild West novel type character that's, you know, displayed in illustrations and through these like lengthy narratives, to seeing a life-size, you know, Jemez person telling you a story as a person. And so, yeah, it makes it more real and more human. I remembered one other aspect of like immersive exhibits that we've done, and it's actually the biggest thing that you see when you go into Jemez, and it's the floor. So we've actually had digitally routered wood floor, which is a map of the historic site. And it's still in the process of being finished so that people can walk on it. But our goal is that it's an inhabitable map so that people can walk around on the map and actually, you know, use it as an interpretive tool.
If you found these discussions of interest, for more information about Jemez Historic Site, you can visit nmhistoricsites.org/Jemez. For more information about IDEUM, their touch tables, their immersive exhibits, their tactile exhibits, you can visit IDEUM.com. Augmented Humanity is a program of the New Mexico Humanities Council, produced in partnership with KUNM-FM. You can visit us online and find out more about our programs at nmhumanities.org. Our theme music comes courtesy James Whiten, string bassist and loop meister extraordinaire.